Thanks, Neil. I have a problem with my voice. I hope I can carry. I'll speak about disease today. So it's quite ironic that I have a very strong cold. Okay, here we are. A couple of remarks before. Thank you so very much, the organizers, to invite me to this. Very happy to be here. And to the birthday boy, I must say that I come with a suitcase full of good wishes from Toronto, which is one of the places where Peter taught a summer school and has been a frequent guest. And many people wish they could be here, but there is enough Toronto and Canadian representation here to honor you in that way. I also must say that I am slightly crossing the picket line this morning. I must announce that at my university, the largest faculty union, has been on strike since midnight yesterday, and with a strike vote of 86%, very strong strike mandate, and the part-time and student faculty of York University are in strike. This is not part of York University, so I'm going to give this talk, but our union, which is the York University Faculty Association, is fully supporting this. I see the smiles of some people who've seen this before and heard me say this before 10 years ago and 7 years ago. The union that is in strike right now is QP 3903, which is has the record in Canada for the longest faculty strike at a Canadian, an English-speaking Canadian university. So we're in for a lot of fun. Anyway, so much for preliminaries. Let me try to get through some of these slides. You're in for something entirely different now. I'm working on a number of issues that push the boundaries of what we have, at least empirically, not abstractly, but in sort of the concrete ways, push the boundaries of what we have defined the city as, and hence my contribution, modest as it might be this morning, is to push a little into that direction and to see where that goes. The beginning of this is this quote from a novel which was published earlier this summer by a Toronto author, Maggie Helwig. It is a novel about an infectious disease outbreak in the subway tunnel system of Toronto. And here, this is the opening of the novel. The city is a winter city as its heart. It is a city that burrows, tunnels, turns underground. It has built strata of malls and pathways and inhabited spaces like the layers in an archaeological dig. A body below the earth, flowing with light. People turn to buried places, to successive levels of basements, lowered courtyards, gardens under glass. There are beauties to winter that are unexpected, the silence of the snow, the intimacy in which, with which we curl around places of warmth. Even the homeless and the outcast travel downwards when they can into the ravines that slice around and under the streets, where the rivers, the Don and the Humber, and their tributaries carve into the heart of the city. They build homes out of tents and slabs of metal siding, decorate them with bicycle wheels and dolls on strings and boxes of discarded books, with ribbons and mittens, and huddle in the cold beside the thin water. It is hard to imagine the city being damaged by something from the sky. The dangers to the city enter the bloodstream, move through interior channels. The main moments of what I'm going to talk about are in this quote about connectivity, flows, metabolism. David mentioned this already. And I'm going to try to explicate some of the implications of seeing a city in this way and connecting it to some of the problems that have arisen due to that connectivity. This should actually say the globalizing cities network in memory of one of Peter's main recent publications. But I wanted to make a point about globalizing cities in general. And the point about that is that there isn't such a thing as a global city or a globalizing city. That sort of thing only exists always in a network. There are no individual properties that you can say this is what defines a global city, but it's always in relationship to other global cities, to other places, that you can find its globalized nature. And this network of globalization is always hierarchically structured. This is not a contradiction. There are, for example, cliques. And there's a clique of cities, for example, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Toronto, where SARS, an infectious disease, I'm going to talk about in a minute, broke out. So the relationship between these global cities have something to do with their hierarchical structured network in which they are. These global cities, they articulate national economies in the global economy and into each other's economy. So it's always about this articulation. And global cities have histories. They're not just around since yesterday. Tim Luke has captured this in this particular quote, and it's really important to say that because he uses global cities with lowercase g and lowercase c. So it's all those cities that are being globalized. And it is the relationship, those metabolic globalized relationships with which they are sustained, that are really important for us to look at. So this is a very short, brief intro, and it is an implied critique of those views of global city and globalizing city theory that have only looked at flows of capital and flows of labor and very economic ways of connecting these places. But it's also a critique that I'm moving into now, where I'm switching the optics from the connectivity and the positive aspects of the connectivity that we have associated with globalizing cities, positive in the sense that they, you know, enable different capital flows, labor flows, and so on, to the problems of vulnerability that lie in the fact that they are networked. So the downsides of connectivity have so far been of little concern. There's always been sort of a literature in global cities theory, you know, most visibly, perhaps in symbolically shown in Mike Davis's City of Quartz, is that there's two cities and there are huge social polarizations. And there are vulnerabilities related to this, but it's, again, about the place and the vulnerabilities of the place between the ghetto and the citadel, but it's not about the network itself. And so what I'm pushing towards now is an understanding of the risks and opportunities that arise from being networked itself. And there are two cases that I've worked through empirically over the last few years and I'm still working on. On the one hand, infectious disease and connectivities related to infectious disease in global cities, and the other one is infrastructure, particularly the relationship of daily life and the threat of disaster in the what we call it Zwischenstadt, the in-between city in Toronto. So I'll show you some images in a moment. That's another quote which I'm going to skip now because of time. So one of the issues is that the spaces that are built for business, the airport lounges, the hotels, the conference facilities, the banking towers, all those things that are so highly connected, in fact, not only by electronic transmissions, but also that by bodies that float around in these spaces, they are also, of course, open to the virus. And that became obvious in 2003 when severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS for short, infected about 300 people in Toronto, it's not altogether clear, and killed 44 people in Toronto and similar amounts of people in other large global cities. And it threw a light on the connectivity between these cities and the lack of our understanding of the problems associated with this. And this triggered all kinds of issues in that are important to urban studies people, to important to urban theory. It highlighted, for example, the spaces of global city diasporas. You know, how do Hong Kong diaspora populations move between these different kinds of cities? At home in Toronto, it highlighted the question of racism because the disease was racialized. It was called at some point the Chinese disease. And it was a fallout for the multiculturalism in Toronto. Globally, it had all kinds of effect for the post-Westphalian governance of health. The WHO entered the fray in a very weak position, particularly vis-a-vis states like the United States and China, and came out of this very much strengthened, perforated the boundaries of China and the United States, and was able to connect to cities in a quite direct way. And it led to a reevaluation of public health, very much in line with what Peter said yesterday about, going back to some sort of understanding of the collective histories of caring for people and so on. So this is these are just a number of ways in which this has been a fallout. Network infrastructure is the other empirical case. Similar, we know most of you probably have seen, Graham and Marvin's work on splintering urbanism, splintering infrastructures. That really guides us in that work here. Also important is that there is a globalized financialization of infrastructure, which Maurice Torrens, amongst others, has worked on. Yesterday, when I arrived at the main station here in Berlin, got out of the train, and there is a big sign up on top of the train station which says Bombardier. And Bombardier is a Canadian infrastructure company. So they've taken hold of, this is a Canadian company financed to a large degree by my tax money. Every time they lose jobs, my tax money goes into there. So the Berlin station, obviously is a place where they're present. So you have these international connections of infrastructure financing, which are similar to the Global Cities Network. So these are just a few pictures I'm going to take you through. You have these kinds of disasters. This is in our backyard at York University a few years ago, just 2 weeks before Hurricane Katrina, incidentally, a washout. This is in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Toronto. It took them 6 months to repair this thing. Created all kinds of problems in the neighborhood. Just a few months ago, 3 months ago, there was a major propane gas explosion just down the road from there. This is very close to the university where I work. And then, you had people in hazardous material suits, traipsed through the neighborhood cleaning the tomatoes of Italian immigrants who live there. So you have this kind of disaster mentality. All right, so I have 5 minutes, and I'm going to speed this up a little bit. Not that I can speed this up much. But so the question that I'm posing here is, out of these new problematics of being networked and being vulnerable to this networked, to these networked relationships, there are new challenges to urban governance, to urban politics. And it is challenging in particular because we need to fight against the hegemonic impulse, particularly after 9/11, to deal with all these issues, whether they are explosions or disease or flooding or whatever, to deal with that in the most authoritarian manner possible. So we need to, as progressive urban theorists, think about other ways to deal with this authoritarian reflex, which also includes escaping the politics of the revanchist city, which has already prepared the ground for this kind of politics. We are already in a situation where, neoliberalism has dismantled a lot of citizenship rights. We are in a situation where it's not quite clear who is responsible for anything, which became absolutely clear during Hurricane Katrina. So the rescaling of new state spaces, Neil's terms, have contributed to the insecurities around this. So we need to ask, how can global cities, globalizing cities, be governed in such a post 9/11 world, and how can they be governed democratically? So I'm going to switch forward now. All of this happens in a neoliberal context, and in the paper I go, quite detailed through, what I consider to be the case now. The point I'm making here is that we need an imminent critique of neoliberalism, that we need to understand the internal contradictions. So I'm going to the same Marx quote that Peter was talking about yesterday about, there's always, every social formation carries in itself the potential of another social formation. So what is this that's coming out now? Jamie's and Adam's terms of roll back and roll out neoliberalism, I think, need to be added to with another term now, which I call roll with it neoliberalism, which is expressive of the internal contradictions that are now happening. I put this in, and I know Lefebvre is misspelled, but he gave us the shoes in which to walk. And I'm sure this was Henri, I'm pretty sure. Gave us the shoe, and the shoes in which to walk through all this and to understand what we need to go back to in this imminent critique to understand what we're coming from, because we came from 1968, if we use this as one way to make a seizure in history, 1968, and a critique of the previous social formation of Fordism and Keynesianism, and how did we carry this through the next generation? I'm going to go very quickly now, so we have, you can read this all in the paper if you must. Here it is, and go to the end. So we have these phases of neoliberalization. We need to now anticipate to some degree where this might be going, so that we can strategically intervene and not be surprised about the next move that comes, but to strategically intervene and prepare the ground for the kind of progressive politics we might get out of this. What I'm opting for is that it's a new urban politics, and what I'm opting for is a progressive outlook on the politics of risk and vulnerability, in which we accept the fact that we have multivariant needs of a widely differentiated urban society, so we cannot go back to the understanding of, let's say, Manuel Castells, writing about collective consumption in a late Fordist environment in France, where you had the working class and the households. But we need to understand the variegated sociologies and geographies of these places, but stick to demands for social justice, the kinds that we carry over from that previous period. And so I'm opting for a politics of resilience and a politics of hope, and to not fall into the trap of fighting fire with fire, to say there is, as Steve Graham in his new fantastic new book that is coming out soon, is talks about the dangers of a military urbanism. We cannot possibly fight the dangers of military urbanism with military powers. We cannot fight disease, the politics of plague, with a plague. We cannot succumb to the kinds of politics that the other side uses in dealing with these kinds of things. So we have to invent something, and Hurricane Katrina, of course, showed us some of those issues. This stuff is everywhere now. I took this 2 weeks ago in Athens, Georgia. Everywhere is the threat of this, and it's being sort of posted around your cities as the next big thing that's going to happen to you. And it's not the chicken that's going to save us. So there's something we need to think about to deal with this. So I'm with people like Olivier Coutard and Simon Guy and others who've now developed this idea of dealing with this technological challenge, to say we need social technologies, environmental technologies, and we need to be against this soft determinism that comes with talking about these things, and find new democratic, socialist, progressive ways of dealing with this, and be anticipatory of the problems that might hit us. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Roger. Next up is Kanishka Gunawardena from University of Toronto.